Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Rest is History, our weekly bonus episode. To give you a sense of where we are, we have last week concluded the Titanic epic. Obviously, you all got that ages ago, but non-club members finished it last week, and we had a live stream, of course. This week, Tom, the storm clouds of religious revolution.
Yes.
Are gathering.
They've been massing, haven't they?
Yeah.
The ship of the Catholic Church has been hurtling towards the iceberg that is Luther. So you should have that.
Definitely.
And I'm imagining that by the time you hear this, the Discord will be rife with theological discussion.
I bet it will.
Pointing out all our mistakes.
No mistakes, surely. And then after Luther is over, we have a complete change of pace and of tone. We have an episode about the men who walked on the moon. So it's not really about the space race, but it's about the characters of the men, the social phenomenon of the moon landings. And we have an episode about 70s America, about disco. So a real change from Martin Luther.
Yeah.
I don't think there's many podcasts that do Martin Luther and disco. And we've also recorded, Tom, haven't we? We won't say what it's for, but we've recorded with a very special guest, haven't we? We haven't had a guest for a while, and we had a really tip-top historical guest.
Yes, a really tip-top guest. And we're just hoping that his or her material has all uploaded satisfactorily.
Yeah.
Particularly because the end of our conversation with this mystery guest
was brilliant.
Was brilliant, wasn't it?
It was. I think it's a guest that, I mean, everybody listening to this podcast will have heard of, but not necessarily one that they'll expect.
I think that's fair to say. So we just put that out there. Dominic, before we get into the questions.
Yes.
Could I just mention something to do with men on the moon?
Do. I'd love that.
So I had lunch yesterday with Francis Young, very distinguished, the historian of basically mad shit.
One of your favourite phrases. Magic. He's magic, isn't he?
Elves and magic and all that kind of thing.
But also Lithuanian paganism.
Yeah. So things that happen on the margin.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff. And I was talking to him about how we were doing the moon. And also, he knows that I'm a big fan of the Green Children of Woolpit, which I think we may have discussed before on this show. If not, I will remind you.
I have no knowledge of what that is.
Okay. So Woolpit is a village in Suffolk.
Right.
That I had read about in a book when I was a child, how in the reign of Stephen and Matilda, you know, the Civil War, 12th century, in this village called Woolpit, these two children appear and they're bright green and they don't speak English. And the boy dies, but the girl survives, grows up, her green colouring fades. And she says that she has come from a land where everything is green and that they had walked into a cave and they'd heard the sound of church bells and they'd walked through the cave and come out and emerged in Woolpit and had never been able to go back. And Woolpit is actually from Wolf Pit. So it's a pit in which wolves have been trapped. So this is thought to be where they come from. And there are two accounts of it in very reputable chronicles, and they sound very, very kind of matter of fact that these children appeared. And so there've been huge debates and discussions about what they might be. And in the book that I read, obviously they were aliens.
Yeah.
Because they were in a book that had a skull with a Roman centurion helmet on it. So it was that kind of thing. And Francis said, oh, well, this is very interesting because the theory that they were actually aliens from the moon goes back to the 17th century. And it's inspired by Galileo observing the moons of Jupiter and his theory that, you know, the Earth is a planet and that they're all revolving around the sun. And so it develops this idea that on other planets, there might be living creatures. So I think this is Burton. So that would be
Anatomy of Melancholy, Robert Burton.
Yeah. He speculates that there be jovial and saturnine inhabitants, infinite worlds, if they be inhabited rational creatures, or have they souls to be saved, or do they inhabit a better part of the world than we do, or are we or they lords of the world, and how are all things made for men? And he then includes a marginal note referencing the green children. It may be the green children came thence. So as far as I know, this is the kind of the earliest reference to little green men.
Wow.
So really fascinating.
Do you know, I'm looking at the story.
It's a brilliant story, isn't it?
I can't get my head around how exciting it is.
Yeah. And then it gets picked up by a guy called Francis Godwin, who is the Bishop of Hereford. And in 1638, it's published posthumously. A book called The Man in the Moon, or A Discourse of a Voyage Thither, was published. And it stars a guy called Domingo Gonzalez, who is carried to the moon in a vehicle drawn by wild swans. And he gets to the moon and he discovers it's inhabited. And the moon inhabitants are much superior to humans on Earth. And this is because the people on the moon send any children who don't measure up down to Earth. And the place where they get sent is a hill in North America. But sometimes the aim of the people who are sending the children down, it goes asquiff. And so sometimes they end up in Europe. And his theory is that maybe this was one of the occasions that they kind of accidentally turned up in Suffolk.
Oh my word.
So intriguing, do you not think?
I think it's fascinating. I've just been looking at the Wikipedia article. You know, I'm not embarrassed to admit that.
Yeah, well, the Bodleian.
And it's an absolutely bizarre story. So their skin was green. They spoke an unknown language.
They only ate beans.
They refused all food for several days until they came across some broad beans, which they consumed eagerly. And then in time, they lost their green colour.
Yeah.
So I'm looking at historians' explanations, and they're fascinating themselves. So there's a guy called Paul Harris. He says they're probably the children of Flemish immigrants.
Mm-hmm. So that's a very popular one.
And what had happened is there had been a battle in the war between Henry II and his son, the young King Henry. Never did really become king, did he?
Well, he gets crowned.
Yes, he does, but he's not counted in the lists, is he?
No.
And there had been rebel forces with a large number of Flemish mercenaries who were defeated nearby. The Flemish mercenaries were slaughtered. The historian, Paul Harris, says there probably were reprisals against Flemish settlers in the area. These children fled to Woolpit. They didn't speak English. They wore Flemish clothes. They would have seemed very weird to the Woolpit villagers, and they were probably suffering from hyperchromic anemia, also known as chlorosis, which is when you have dietary deficiency and you turn green.
You see, I think that's an over-literal explanation.
There's another historian called Derek Brewer who's even more literal. He says they were probably just the children of herders who strayed from their village. They didn't know their home address. They were green because of chlorosis.
They're clearly extraterrestrials. I mean, the simplest explanation is always the easiest.
And then here's my favourite one, Jeffrey Jerome Cohen. He says the green children, it's actually a story about racial difference, Tom. The green children are a memory of the indigenous Britons.
Yeah.
Chroniclers remembering the indigenous Britons. And the green children represent an adjacent world that cannot be annexed, an otherness that will perish to endure, whatever that means. Anyway, what an interesting story.
I mean, Francis Young's interested in it. It's evident partly because he's from Suffolk.
Yeah.
But also because his book on the godlings, which is the word he gives to describe indeterminate supernatural figures in Roman Britain,
mm-hmm.
who are midway between the Olympian gods and humans.
So kind of like spirits almost.
Fauns, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Fates, the Cucullati, the hooded gods. And it's a kind of thesis. I mean, he's too good a historian to kind of go in and say it's definitely the case, but he kind of teases through the possibility that what become elves and fairies and so on, they have been transformed by the collapse of Roman power and by Christianization, and that these are figures that inhabit a Christian world, but lie beyond the ability of the church to patrol it.
Okay. Yeah.
So very interesting. But the children of Woolpit are really different, I think. They are not seen as belonging to, you know, a different order of creature. They're not kind of fairies or elves or whatever.
Yeah, they're children.
They are children from a different world. And that's what makes it so strange and unusual and fascinating.
Just a question for you about Francis Young. He would not answer this so bluntly, so I couldn't ask him. Does he believe that such things existed?
I think rather in the way that Tolkien did.
Okay. He believes that they believed it.
Well, I was discussing exactly this point yesterday because I was so interested in what he wrote because it kind of meshed with something that I've been interested in a long while, which is how a materialist tradition, which is what history in the 21st century is, mm-hmm. copes with the fact that for most of history, people have not had materialist assumptions.
Mm-hmm.
And if you apply materialist assumptions to beliefs in the past, how can you possibly hope to understand them?
Yeah.
And I think that I don't want to put words into his mouth, but that you have to essentially suspend your disbelief if you properly want to get to grips with
right.
custom, because if you just assume that they're things that can be explained away in a kind of rational way,
yeah.
Oh, they, you know, they have some hypothermia that makes them green or whatever, or their Jungian repressed memory or something.
Yeah.
Because the classic one for me, which I've talked about before on the episode we did on Athens and democracy, is the thing about the girls becoming bears.
Yeah.
And nobody ever says, oh, well, maybe they become bears. But if you think that's a possibility, then it opens up whole dimensions that open up all aspects of kind of Athenian culture in a way that otherwise you wouldn't have.
Tom, we talked about this before, because I remember saying to you before that my tutor, Mark Witto at Oxford, having a conversation with him about...
Yeah, about the icons.
Icons, yeah. Whether they really worked. And he said, yeah, but you don't know that they didn't. I mean, you know. But that said, so I've been thinking about this since we had last had the conversation about suspending your disbelief. The fact is, though, that you cannot write other than as yourself, right?
No, you can't.
I mean, okay, you suspend your disbelief because the very act of what you're doing is a rationalist 21st century thing. Of course, you can get into their heads, but you'll always be you.
Yeah, but I would say that I am trying to put my kind of rational gear stick, he said, torturing a metaphor, slightly into neutral.
Okay.
So that I can open myself to the possibility that all kinds of strange things happened. I just feel it's a more creative and historically valid way of looking at the past. I mean, obviously, that's not the case if you're studying
Harold Wilson,
Edward Heath's incomes policy. I mean, I accept that.
Yeah.
But if you're looking at, you know, what the ancient Athenians thought, or maybe even people in 12th century Suffolk, I feel it opens up ways of understanding the past.
But there's a tension there, isn't there? Because you're writing as somebody who ultimately, let's be frank, you don't believe in elves. I mean, you just don't believe that elves exist. I mean, you don't. You're making all the faces, but I know you don't really believe in elves. And you know that of your audience, of your readers, I would say 99 out of 100, if not 100 out of 100, also don't believe in elves. So although you're both maybe making an effort to understand, that's got to be there as a shadow the whole time.
Okay. Well, I think next year, when perhaps we'll be going back to doing guests, we should get Francis on and ask him to do, he said he would, or I've already asked him without telling you.
Shocking.
To do an episode on elves.
Right.
And we can pursue exactly this line of inquiry. Because I think Tolkien is an interesting example of someone who was clearly, you know, I mean, he was a brilliant, brilliant scholar who nevertheless kind of created things that he wanted to believe might actually be true.
Yeah. The truth is, of course, that there is no hard and fast division between what we believe and what we don't believe, is there?
No.
I mean, all the people who look at their horoscope or who have little superstitions. You know, I always put my right shoe on when I'm going to a job interview first. You know, that kind of thing. And are imprisoned by it. And you're like, come on, do you really believe that? And they'll say, what will I do when I don't?
So we were in the middle of the Luth series.
Yeah.
I mean, the possibility the devil exists.
Yeah.
Kind of dramatizes Luther's life and thinking, I think. Rather than just saying, oh, well, he had intestinal complaints, or it's all about his bowels, or... I mean, I just find that so reductive.
Agreed. It is reductive. So when you're writing about it, obviously you're very conscious of the fact that Luther thinks the devil does exist. And he genuinely thinks the devil was in a dog or whatever. And I think, as you say, if you just say, well, actually, he just had a terrible constipation, then that is too reductive because you miss what made Luther tick. But that said, if I was writing about that, I would be unable ultimately, because even if I pretended I believed the devil existed and had taken the shape of a dog, I'd be lying to myself because I don't really think that. And at some stage, you have to admit that. You have to be honest with yourself as a historian.
But maybe it's a matter of suspending your inherent skepticism and really trying to imagine what the world would be like if the devil did exist.
Yeah, agreed.
So it's not just about what would it be like to believe in the devil.
Yeah.
But what if the devil did exist? It's just going a little bit further.
Yes, agreed. That's a good way of doing it. That's a very nice way of putting it. I think you have to do both things as a historian. You are yourself trying to make sense of it and being honest, being true to yourself, but also you have to make an imaginative effort.
Right.
Don't you? To see the world as they saw it.
But I think it's just also the broader point that for most of history, materialist interpretations haven't had any currency.
Agreed.
So we are unusual by the standards of previous generations of humanity.
Although it kind of goes back to thinking about, thinking about all the sources that I read when I did my adventure in time about Alexander. Some of them, the gods are more involved than others, and some of them they're barely involved at all. That tension between materialists and non-materialists has always been there to some degree, hasn't it?
But I think even in the ones where the gods aren't intervening directly,
they think they're there.
They may not even be thinking overtly in terms of the gods, but that there is a supernatural dimension.
Yeah.
And that Alexander is an actor within the supernatural as well as the natural dimension, I think is really important to understanding the impact he has.
Yeah, that's fair. Whereas we've stripped that out.
Yeah. So if you just talk about Alexander purely in materialist terms, you miss so much.
Agreed. Because, of course, when he goes to that oracle at Siwa, he doesn't go for materialist reasons, does he? He goes because he thinks this really matters and this is something really important. We should do some questions, Tom.
We should.
So a quick question for you from James von Shetland. He says, aside from Ophir, this is from the Carthage episodes, aside from Ophir mentioned in the Carthage episodes, are there any places lost to history as myth? So I guess mythical places that could be real. So Atlantis, you don't think is real?
Well, so James, I'm assuming is from Shetland.
Right.
So Shetland is one of the many places that was identified with a place called Thule.
Mm, yeah.
Who we talked about, I think, in the Nazi episode.
Yeah.
Didn't we? There was a whole society devoted to Thule. And it was this land in the far north that classical geographers referred to. And it's clearly a place that, well, actually, it's an open question. I think most people would say that it is the idea that there is a land in the distant north where it's far beyond the ocean, but that it is accessible. And so there have been various theories about it, that it might be Britain, or it might be Orkney, or it might be Shetland, or it might be Iceland, or it might be Greenland, or even that it might be America. So maybe it's all of them or none of them.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the quest for Thule is certainly a part of what drives classical adventurers. So Pythias, the Massiliot Greek adventurer, I think in the 3rd century, he talks about it. And Agricola sends a fleet that glimpses Thule, and that is definitely Shetland.
God, that's interesting, isn't it?
And so you will have references to Thule on the stained glass in the town hall, the Victorian town hall on Shetland.
Okay.
So I hope James von Shetland is happy with that answer.
That's a nice answer. I hadn't expected that.
Shall I give you a question from Kay? It's about the Titanic.
Oh, I was dreading Kay's question.
Why was Belfast so different to the rest of Ireland? Why was their capital invested to industrialise Belfast, but not the rest of the country?
Oh, it's a complicated question. Belfast, of course, is Protestant, largely Protestant, Scottish and English settlers.
So is that what, Protestant work ethic? Is that what you're saying?
No, it's not Protestant work ethic, but it's just regarded differently. It's not in hock to landlords in the same way that so much of rural Ireland is. Ireland is very, very rural and very, you know, the soil is peaty. It's much more of a kind of subsistence economy than England was in the early modern period. It's harder to industrialize. There's obviously the prejudice. There is the religious animosity. It's astonishing, actually. Paul Rouse talks about this in that thing that I was telling you about, the National Archives of Ireland thing that he did. It was for a census. That's what it was. It was for the anniversary of a census. And he wrote a whole load of sort of web pages about Ireland in 1911 or something like that. And he talks about just how not yet industrialized a lot of what we now think of as the major Republic of Ireland cities are.
But you were comparing Belfast to Glasgow or Liverpool or Manchester.
But that's exactly the comparison. It's much more like them than it is like Dublin or...
But why? Is it the Protestantism?
I think that's a large part of it.
Is it the different patterns of land ownership?
Yeah, I think that's exactly a large part of it too.
Yeah,
I think, Paul's expression? He says, in Dublin, wealth is based on land and lineage. And in Belfast, it is based on industry.
Self-made men.
Yeah.
So like Manchester.
Yeah, I think Belfast, people have often said this about Belfast. I remember writing about this when I wrote White Heat, my book on the 60s. And I had chapters in there about the origins of the Troubles that I hope one day will become the beginning of a series that we do on this. Belfast, people would always say it when they went in the 60s, they'd say it feels like you're going to a northern city that's been dropped into the top of Ireland. Now, of course, Belfast has dimensions that Sheffield or Manchester or wherever don't have.
Yeah.
But it does in physically. I mean, you were there recently, weren't you, Tom? Physically, it doesn't look so different from English or Scottish cities.
It's a very handsome city.
Yeah, handsome in quite a brooding way, I would say. Would you agree with that?
Yeah.
And if you go to the Falls Road, the Shankill Road, the places where the action of the Troubles happened, it's quite claustrophobic, I would say. You know, it's the narrow streets of terraced brick houses. This is one of the things that gave the conflict its horror, that it's so intimate, that the most sort of radical and militant members of the two communities
are rubbing up against each other.
Rubbing up so close against each other, exactly. Anyway, that's a slight evasion, because actually I don't know enough about the economic history of Ireland to answer Kay's question properly. But it's a good question. Sorry, that's just totally evasive. What about, okay, here's a question for you on your home turf. John A. MacDonald. So John A. MacDonald has been listening to the historical Jesus. You referenced the passage by Josephus that was clearly Christianized. Remember you said that? You said there's a source that Christian authors have later tampered with.
Yeah.
Classical texts were presumably maintained through the ages by Christian monks, among other Christian institutions. Why were pagan texts not altered or ignored or destroyed altogether? So why did any survive?
Because monks were committed to the preservation of learning.
Yeah.
And classical texts were the basis of learning. So I think that they would copy as many pagan as Christian texts. I mean, the idea that they were setting out to destroy pagan learning is a kind of Enlightenment myth.
Catherine Nixey.
Well, I mean, it's simply not true.
Yeah.
Because if monks had not copied them, we wouldn't have anything.
Yeah. It's a sort of Professor Alice Roberts fantasy.
It is.
That Christians hate learning and stuff, isn't it?
Yeah. So A.C. Grayling is very, I mean, he wrote a book where he made exactly this point, and it's completely wrong. And the most cursory glance at Wikipedia would tell him it was wrong.
Right.
But it's a myth. And atheists have their myths just as, you know, other believers have their myths that are important to them.
Yeah.
On the specific question of, you know, why did they not adapt classical texts that mention Jesus? So actually the obvious one is Tacitus, who does mention Jesus and Christians in the course of describing how Nero blames them for the fire, the great fire. There has been a recent argument that it is an interpolation, and it's a very, very minority position. And the reason for thinking that is that there are no variations in grammar. It sits perfectly correctly within the broader fabric of the text. And if it had been a Christian changing it, it would have bigged Jesus up a lot more than it does. And that is how you can tell that the Josephus one is an interpolation, because it's making claims that only a Christian would make.
Okay.
And I think that, I'm sure we talked about this in the episode, I can't remember, but the likeliest explanation is that there was a reference to Jesus in Josephus, that you can just about kind of work out what the original core was, but that there was a kind of whole accretion added to it.
Okay. So I'm going to answer a question myself, Tom.
Go for it, Dominic.
A question to myself from Michael Jones. Michael Jones says, having looked at so many newspapers when writing your books and written for several yourself, have you been able to pick up how Britain's newspapers have changed? This is a kind of pet subject of mine. So I think the fascinating thing about this is how little they've changed. So in our Titanic episodes, we talked about W.T. Stead, didn't we, Tom? The guy who called Gordon is the man for Khartoum.
Yeah, and whose daughter was
visited by a poet.
Visited by a minor poet.
Yeah. Yeah.
The ghost of.
So W.T. Stead, I think, is the presiding genius of British newspapers. And Stead's thing, well, I could bore on about this for hours. Our American listeners, you know, will have a sense, even if they're not newspaper readers, they'll have a sense from their general American culture that newspaper writing is an honorable craft. They'll have seen films about it, all the president's men or whatever. You know, a trade where you strive for accuracy and integrity, and it really matters to get things right, and you're doing a noble job. I don't think that most British people involved in newspapers just start laughing when they hear that, because we're much more the children of W.T. Stead, which is basically make them laugh, make them cry, make them angry, throw the kitchen sink at it, and then write your apologies afterwards. And I'm always struck by the continuities in British papers. Now, some have changed. The Times used to be incredibly stuffy and really quite boring in the mid-20th century. But the newspapers that I used a lot, so I used the two best-selling papers of the sort of 50s, 60s, 70s, writing my books, the Daily Express and the Daily Mirror. I mean, they are no different. from what they are today. They've gone through different incarnations. They look different. There have been changes of mood. But the obsessions of the papers have never really changed. You know, sensationalism, crime, footballers behaving badly, all of those kinds of things. I think there is a deep kind of continuity there. Or The Guardian, let's say. The Guardian's tone, I would say it's become a slightly caricatured version of itself in a way that it wasn't even in the 80s or something. But it's always been a little bit, you know, well-meaning, high-minded, a little bit finger-wagging, a little bit priggish maybe. Same with The Telegraph, The Mail.
Telegraph's gone quite mad recently.
The Telegraph is, yeah. Tom, we've got a lot of Telegraph journalists who love The Rest Is History. You can't abuse it.
Okay, well, I apologise.
Yeah, it's shocking.
I mean, honestly, all their, why everything's gone wrong.
Yeah.
Everything's terrible. We're all doomed.
I think there was a phase of trust enthusiasm at The Telegraph.
Yeah, I feel a bit embarrassed about that.
Probably wasn't the paper's finest hour.
Yeah.
But I think there's, don't you? I mean, we're so conscious of it in Britain, aren't we? You grow up with it. If you're at all interested in the media, you're so conscious of the very starkly contrasting.
But I think it's really faded. I mean, I was thinking, watching the David Beckham documentary. Have you seen that?
No, I've seen clips of him dissing his wife for lying about her class background.
It's really good. I really enjoyed it. It's great fun. And it just kind of took me back to that period. And just thinking how carnivorous and powerful the tabloids were in particular.
Yeah, of course.
And how they're just shadows of themselves now.
They are, of course.
And also all the stuff about, you know, the phone hacking and the royal family and everything. I mean, it was just, they were terrifying. And kind of in the way that all kind of terrifying bullies are, kind of, if you're not being bullied, you know, you can't keep your eyes off them.
Yeah, I think the phone hacking was a massive blow to the British tabloid press, in which arguably it's never really recovered in terms of public esteem. But I think there is something, I know people love to say how terrible the papers are, but I think at their best, there is something quite 18th century, quite vital and earthy. And in some ways, I think high-minded people, dare I say, rest is politics-y kind of people, they say, gosh, this has debased our political culture and all this kind of thing. But actually, I think at their best, what those papers did was they provided a kind of skepticism and a vitality.
At their best.
Yeah.
But at their worst, it was just rank bullying.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Yeah.
Well, you're much more critical of rank bullying than I am.
I think that is probably true.
All right. A final question for you. It's about the series Shogun. I haven't seen this yet.
No, I haven't either.
I think it looks brilliant. I love this kind of thing. So I'm looking forward to watching it. Jokey Jack says that in Shogun, an Englishman arrives in Portuguese-influenced Japan in the 1600s. The Englishman frequently refers to himself as a Protestant and the Portuguese as Catholics. I've actually seen clips in which this happens. This absolutely does happen. Would somebody in this period have used those terms, and would they have divided Europe into Protestant and Catholic in that way, Tom?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, Protestant is pretty early.
Right.
So it's a group of princes. I think it's 1529, perhaps.
Right.
In fact, let me just, because I wrote about it in Dominion and I can't remember.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's 1529.
It's great that instead of Googling it, you look in your own book.
Look up my own. Shall I quote myself?
Do. Everyone loves that.
Yeah, so five Lutheran princes in 1529 summoned to an imperial diet. They had dared to object to measures passed there by the Catholic majority by issuing a formal protestation.
Right.
By 1546, when Luther died, commending his spirit into the hands of the God of truth, other princes too had come to be seen as Protestant and not only in the empire.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, you will get certainly references in English to Protestants.
Well, the word in England in the 17th century, people would have said papist, wouldn't they?
Oh, Catholics.
Yeah, they'd have reached for papist rather than Catholic.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
Well, when we do our mighty series on 17th century Britain.
Yeah, we'll check out on all this.
We will definitely get into all this.
But what I would say, just one final thing, and I think we talked about this in the Luther series, the Catholic Church as an idea is bred of the Reformation.
Yes.
I mean, Catholicos means universal. So that's why lots of churches claim to be Catholic. But the identification of it, you know, you can refer to Catholic Christianity in the Middle Ages, I suppose, but it doesn't quite have the signification that it comes to have after the Reformation, and particularly the Counter-Reformation.
Okay. So just to give people a sense where we are, I've just been looking at the schedule. We have the Moonwalkers episode, we have Disco, and then, Tom, a absolutely tremendous series full of melodrama and colour.
We have Lord Byron, yes.
So this is about sex and kind of Regency England. It is about celebrity, the birth of celebrity culture. It's about the Balkans.
It's about Napoleonic Wars.
Napoleonic Wars, Greek nationalism, the Ottoman Empire.
Frankenstein.
Romanticism, all bundled together in the life of this extraordinary character. So that's definitely one to look forward to. And on that bombshell, Tom, we seem to have been recording all day. So we should probably...
And now I've got to go and write up notes on Byron.
Ah, wonderful.
Fun times.
All right. Bye, everybody. Thank you so much for listening. Thanks for your support. And we'll see you next time.
Bye-bye.